This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program, February 24 of the year 2010. Interesting Wednesday, isn't it? Ask Anything Wednesday is always interesting for me. And today we're going to have a classic program of Ask Anything Wednesday. And just before that, let's turn to some issues in the news. Big news coming out in terms of Lutheranism worldwide. We've been following so many of the debates going on in mainline, more liberal Protestantism, having to do with issues of doctrinal teaching, where you have theological liberalism becoming more and more the order of the day, and, of course, positions on issues such as the legalization of same-sex marriage, the ministry of openly gay clergy, and all the rest. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, that's the mainline group of Lutherans, the largest Lutheran denomination, took a radical step back in August to the left on the issue of homosexuality, deciding to allow partnered gay clergy to serve, and allowing the option of endorsing same-sex relationships. Some conservative Lutherans began immediately to meet, talking about pulling out or coming up with a new structure for Lutheranism in America. And they have, saying that they are done. This is Religion News Service reporting, saying they are done with efforts to reform the nation's largest Lutheran body. Dissidents unveiled blueprints on Thursday of last week for a rival denomination to be known as the North American Lutheran Church, or NALC. It's going to be more traditional on issues of biblical authority and human sexuality. It's expected to be launched in August, and it'll be interesting to see the kind of energy that goes into this. But by and large, what happens is that in the main, the pattern is for a minority of churches to pull out, but for those churches to pull out to be the churches, the congregations that generally are also growing. And so that's what I expect here. I expect you're going to have a handful, or larger than a handful, but certainly a minority, the 4.6 million members, to pull out of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America as a matter of theological principle. And when they pull out, my guess is they will be the churches in that denomination that had been growing the most and will continue to grow. No one knows exactly right now how large the new North American Lutheran Church is going to be, but a significant number of churches have indicated that they want to leave the ELCA. Now, I appreciate this. The new denomination says it will be, and I quote, faithful in its preaching and practice to the Holy Bible and to the teachings of Lutheran confessions. I think it's very, very interesting when you see this. The same thing happened, of course, in the Presbyterian Church, where you had the exit of conservative Presbyterians who started the PCA back in the 1970s, the Presbyterian Church in America, later the EPC, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. You see this in the Anglican Communion, where now you have the North American Anglican Council made up of churches that by and large had been Episcopalian but left the Episcopal Church U.S. over its theological liberalism. Religion News Service reports the new body would mark the second major U.S. church schism over homosexuality in as many years. In 2009, conservative Episcopalians launched the Anglican Church in North America, which now claims some 800 congregations in the U.S. and Canada. Now, by the way, that new Anglican body includes not just a handful of churches, but this is a large group, talking about 800 churches in the U.S. and Canada. Be interesting to see now. By the way, there was a little bit, if not a great amount, of irony and symbolism in the fact that this new church, the North American Lutheran Church, was announced on the 464th anniversary of the death of Martin Luther, the great Protestant reformer whose name, of course, is given to the denomination, the date on which Lutherans celebrate Martin Luther as a renewer of the Christian church, as this new denomination intends to be a part of the renewal of the church on the basis of the Word of God. Be very interesting to see how that turns out, but I have to say best wishes to the North American Lutheran Church. It'll be interesting to see what happens in terms of the Episcopal Church. What's left in the Episcopal Church? Well, when you had so many conservatives leave over the last couple of years, you've had the diocese in Pittsburgh leave, a major diocese in the San Joaquin Valley leave of California. You've had several hundred breakaway congregations, but that means that basically the liberals are left. But even, it turns out, some of the liberals are not sure what to do on these issues right now. The Episcopal Diocese of Virginia, which is the largest single diocese of the Episcopal Church U.S., has now backpedaled away from recognizing same-sex unions. Over the weekend, last weekend, it decided to form a panel of lay and clergy that will set standards for church-sanctioned blessings of such unions should they be approved by the entire 2 million member Episcopal Church. So what it looks like is that this diocese that had been kind of on the leading edge of pushing the church to endorse the blessing of same-sex unions is now going to await for the entire denomination to take its stance. It'll be very interesting to watch. Of course, there in the Episcopal Church, you have a church that in recent weeks was informed that it's likely to have its second openly gay bishop, as Canon Mary Glasspool of Baltimore is expected to be consecrated this coming May in Los Angeles after having been elected by the diocese there in Los Angeles. Big report out by the Pew Research Center, which is part of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. Religion among the millennials. The subtitle is less religiously active than older Americans, but fairly traditional in other ways. Now, here are some very significant findings in this report. Every time these statistical reports come out, you're tempted to look at it and say, well, just another report. We're surrounded by marketing surveys, by polls, by huge sociological instruments and research projects. So what matter does it make? Well, when you look at this one, it suggests a couple of things we need to note. Number one, this particular generation of millennials, young adults, and they're especially about aged 18 to 30, this generation of young adults is very traditional on some issues. And by the way, more conservative even than their parents on issues like abortion. But on issues like homosexuality, they're far less traditional. By and large, this generation is very open to the normalization of homosexuality. It tells you, again, the drift of the culture. It tells you what they've received in terms of education. It tells you what they've been listening to in terms of the media and entertainment and what they consider as normal. This is a denominational cohort in terms of our churches that tend to be somewhat missing. That's also verified in this report. When you start looking at this generation, you'll notice that even though they report themselves very spiritual, they are not necessarily very involved in a local congregation. Very interesting data that comes out from this. We get these reports from time to time. Are they less religious? Well, they're certainly less religious in terms of their practice, but not in terms of how they define their spirituality. You're talking about a significant number of these young adults who may not follow the pattern of generations before them. Well, what was that pattern? The pattern that had been set for the last four or five generations is that when young adults reach the age of about 18 to 22, they tended to fall off from church attendance. But as soon as they got married and had kids, they started to come back. Well, you know, on this program, we've been talking about the delay of marriage. We've been talking about the delay of childbearing. Well, now it turns out there is at least a delay, if not an absence, of return to the church. Because as it turns out, the traditional pattern of exiting the church at 18 to 22 in terms of activity and attendance and then coming back about 27 or 28, that's not happening. These young adults are not coming back in any significant numbers, even through age 30. Very interesting, nonetheless, they consider themselves spiritual. As one of the researchers says, they just want to experience God. Well, this tells us something about how this generation has been shaped, I think, by two aspects of American culture that ought to have our note. The first is this idea of individual autonomy. They really think they can just do it themselves. They can just be a church unto themselves. And insofar as they do that, you know, why leave the dorm room? Why not just stay in my apartment? I can be spiritual here as much as I can be spiritual, to use that word, elsewhere. And there again, I think they've been drinking deeply from the wells their own parents have dug when it comes to embracing autonomy. And then the second issue, of course, has to do with the fact that the New Age and postmodern worldview has so filtered down to the lay level where the average person lives, and certainly these millennials are very shaped by this, young adults aged 18 to 30, that they genuinely believe that spirituality is what matters, having a spiritual aspect to their lives, having some kind of spiritual understanding, being involved in some kind of spiritual quest, involving oneself in some kind of spiritual ritual. What's missing from that is truth. This is a generation, again, that has been drinking from the wells that were dug by their parents. Once you minimize truth, well, then you're left with nothing more than spirituality, as anyone would wish to basically to conjure up their own formula. And that's where an awful lot of Americans are. And when, frankly, you look at that phenomenon in America, it's not limited to the millennials aged 18 to 30. You'll find an awful lot of their parents and aunts and uncles and even a frightening percentage of their grandparents doing the same thing. As the old adage goes, the chickens do come home to roost. So when we look at these young Americans, the millennials aged 18 to 30, we're seeing a reflection of America. of their parents and grandparents and of the institutions and experiences that shaped them. And it tells you something of the mission field. Parents, this ought to be a wake-up call for you, just in terms of thinking not only of the millennials, but of younger children and adolescents. Are you making the truth issues clear? And it's also a reminder to us of the mission field we face in postmodern America. Folks, when you look at a research report like this, it's not just for your intellectual stimulation. It should be for your evangelistic strategy as well. We've got to redouble our efforts to reach out to the millennials with the gospel. Back for a classic Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. It's Ask Anything Wednesday. We're glad to talk about what's on your mind. We were glad to get a call from Stephen, who was unable to stay. His question was, what are your thoughts about taking out debt for college? Does Scripture speak to this? Scripture certainly speaks to being wise in terms of stewardship, financial management, savings. It speaks of actual investment and of the wisdom of being prudent with finances. You know, I think I'm in an unusual position to speak to this, and as a college and seminary president, I really believe in education. Education costs money. There's no way around it. And there is an investment and reward formula that's very much in your mind when you go to college. Hopefully that you're not just putting that in financial terms. I mean, I think the most important aspect of education isn't financial, but the financial aspect is certainly there. And what may surprise people is I just want to come down thunderously to say, I think there are very, very few situations in which it is prudent to take out any kind of significant debt for education. I think it is very, very risky. And I think in the long run, it is more likely to bring harm rather than benefit into an individual's life. And I'll tell you why. Debt itself is a very difficult thing to overcome. I mean, you just look at the way debt is structured. To come out of a very young phase of life, entering into a career or a profession, and to have that enormous amount of debt that can easily accumulate and can easily be rationalized for education, that can come crushing down on a life. It can come crushing down on the life of a young couple. It can come crushing down on the life of an individual. And when we start talking about the reasons why, for instance, people aren't getting married at ages like they should be, I believe, and why they're delaying childbearing and all the rest, I think that has a lot to do with it. As a Christian, I know there are an awful lot of young Christians who ought to be on the mission field somewhere. They ought to be doing something for the cause of the Great Commission, but because of a crushing load of debt, they really can't do that. Now, I have two things to back up and make sure I make clear. Number one, I'm not suggesting that you do not get that education. I'm suggesting that there are all kinds of ways to get a good quality education that do not require you to sink your own financial ship. They should not. And, you know, you just start looking at the cost of some institutions and you realize, yes, my child would like to attend that institution, but there's no way we can actually do that, or it can bring either an enormous exposure to debt into our lives and into the child's life, or it can bring, for that matter, an enormous hardship on the family. I can tell you there are good educational values out there. There are opportunities and alternatives to what many people would conceptualize and just imagine right up front as the obvious place for either a student to go or for a parent to send. And I would just encourage you to look around at the alternatives and recognize that the world's a big place. And here in the United States, one of the things we should be thankful for is that there are all kinds of educational opportunities. I'm far more concerned with you as Christians finding a place that is ideologically, worldview, healthy for your child. And then you put all that together. And as you evaluate institutions and evaluate alternatives, a lot of things will come to mind. Now, I also want to say that as I began the answer, I said there are a few situations in which that's justified. Let me tell you what one of those situations might be. For example, someone had the opportunity to go to medical school, and medical school costing a certain amount of money. Almost everyone going to medical school has to take on a certain amount of indebtedness. And if in a certain professional context like this, on the other side, there's already a very clear understanding of how that's going to be managed and how that's going to be handled. If we only sent to medical school the people who could afford to go to medical school, I don't think we'd have many doctors. So there are some exceptions to this rule, but that's not where most students are. That's not where most people are making this decision. And even where something like medical school is the focus of attention, there might be other alternatives as well. I mean, I know people well who got their medical degree as they were in an ROTC program and entered into military service. And so both the individual and the society and the military benefited from that kind of program. So just be really careful. You know, I'm not Dave Ramsey. I'm not a financial advisor. I don't pose as one. I am a theologian, and I do know how to add. And I can tell you that debt adds up to a big problem. And so I'm just going to suggest that in almost any situation where debt can be avoided, it should be. And especially when it comes to education, be very, very careful. Let's go to Jeff calling from Tampa, listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Jeff.
Dr. Mueller, it's a pleasure and honor to talk to you. Real quick question regarding birth control. As a Christian, as a member of a Southern Baptist church from the South, I've done quite a bit of research, and I can find why how many methods are, you know, should not be used regarding the pill and hormonal things and what's not okay. What I'm having trouble finding is there anything that is okay and acceptable as a form of birth control?
Jeff, God bless you for asking the question. Let me tell you, one of the problems in modern evangelicalism is that too few people are even asking the question. This really caught us unawares. And I do a lot of talking and speaking about this. I've written a lot about it. And if you go to my website at albertmoeller.com and just put in birth control or contraception, you're going to get a flood of material. But I'm not just going to punt and say, go do that. I want to tell you there's certain things I want to just set down, even in the brief time we have before we have to go into a break. I am thankful you're asking the question. Too many evangelicals really fail to see there's a great moral and spiritual question to be answered here. I want to say, first of all, that we can't join the contraceptive revolution and just see the secular logic of birth control pills and all the rest is acceptable. You know, we don't consider children to be a disease we want to be vaccinated against. And there's a real moral danger in seeing children as a commodity you just decide to have. There's something about marriage and the conjugal union of the man and the woman and the gift of sex that is to imply procreation. Now, I'm not saying that a Christian couple can never use birth control of any kind. But we can't buy into the idea that birth control should just be the natural thing to do. The birth control is just justified just because it exists. That's not true. It's not true of any technology, certainly one that gets to the very heart of what it means to be human, as does birth control. We have to see children as divine gifts, as gifts of God to be welcomed under any circumstance, and not to be seen as some kind of pestilence that we want to be without and we want to take a pill to avoid. There are real abortifacient worries about hormonal birth control, Jeff, when it comes to the pill and to some other hormonal agents of birth control. And for that reason, I'm not a doctor. I stipulate that. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a pharmacist. But I can read, and I know what's going on. I know the physician's desk reference for most of these lists a potential abortifacient effect. And as one who believes in the sanctity and dignity of every single human life at every stage of development, I'm going to say I can't go that way. Without really, really ensuring that there is no abortifacient risk to whatever birth control method I may be choosing. So the bottom line is I think there are birth control methodologies and technologies that are lower risk. Barrier methods are the lowest risk of all, just to make that very clear, Jeff. So using barrier methods, a condom and other things, that's the lowest risk. And, of course, I'm talking here about a married couple. Let's be clear about that. We're not talking about facilitating sex outside of marriage. But we're talking about a couple, a Christian couple, trying to be good stewards to glorify God in every dimension of their lives, including their sexuality and procreative life and reproductive expectations. I think it's all really important. Now, I would suggest, just because there's no way I can say as much here as I would want to say, and even when I speak about this in church settings and elsewhere when it's appropriate, it takes a while to kind of lay this out, but I've done the best job I can to put this stuff into writing, and you'll find it at albertmoeller.com. There are also entire programs dedicated to this, Jeff, which I think we can make available as you go to the website for today's program. We'll put some links up to where we've discussed this more thoroughly before. God bless you for asking the question, and I tell you what, Jeff gave us all a gift by calling and asking that question. What's your question? I guarantee you, I'm not the only one that wants to know. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with more.
Is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome back to Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mueller Program. I published a major article at my website today. The website is, of course, albertmueller.com. That's M-O-H-L-E-R.com. The title of my article is Truth Really Plural? Postmodernism in Full Flower. It's a review of a new book by John Franke, a professor at Biblical Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania. His new book is entitled Manifold Witness, The Plurality of Truth. And we're going to be talking about this later this week, because it's one of those arguments that suggests something very cunning and subtle, and that is that truth can be more than one thing, that truth is inherently plural. And that is one of those things that opens up an entire postmodern world, because it really subverts any effort to say that Christianity is this and not that, that the gospel is this and not that. It undercuts our ability to speak about truth in any way that that is more than a constant negotiation between the culture and the biblical text and all the rest. You'll find my engagement with and a review of the book at albertmueller.com. It's a pretty lengthy article. And if you're concerned with what's happening in the church and in the so-called emerging church or the emergent church, that'd be a good place to look. The phone number for Ask Anything Wednesday is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Ozark, Missouri. Lane's listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Lane.
Yes, Dr. Mueller. I'm curious. I've been monitoring and following the multi-site church and studying it even for our own church some. And one of the primary arguments really that opposes it is the understanding in the book of Acts that one of the essentials or essences of the church is their being together principally in one location, and mostly the my understanding is in Acts 9, I believe it's 30 or 31, where the use of the word ecclesia is given is the one allowance potentially for that interpretation. But I'm just curious as to your understanding of that, and also when they say being biblically faithful to the text versus the mandate of the Great Commission to reach people, those seem to be pitting themselves against one another. How would you advise to reconcile those two?
Yeah, Lane, what a good set of questions. And by the way, we had a fascinating discussion of these issues and a panel discussion here at Southern Seminary yesterday, and had a really good crew of folks here to talk about it. And you'll find a link to that. We're going to put up, you can find the video and the audio with today's program. We're going to put that up. And very interesting discussion. And some of the very issues that Lane just brought out came out in that discussion. And I'll tell you, the issue of taking the book of Acts, and by the way, we don't take the entirety of the New Testament, but in specific, the book of Acts, and figure out exactly how that fits here, well, that leads to some challenges. Not impossible, though. That's what we're obligated to. If we are going to be regulated by Scripture, then we're going to have to come to terms with what the Scripture sets out here. And so, Lane, as much as I can try to just kind of summarize what I would say in response to this, it is that I think classically, when you think of the church, you think of the church gathered together. You think of the church in one place. We have to be really careful, though, that we do not practice anachronism, which means that we do not assume that what we see and what we experience has always been normative. For instance, when you look at the book of Acts, when these churches often gather together, there's no reference to a building. So they were gathering together. One reference is to gathering together at Solomon's portico or Solomon's porch there at the temple. So evidently there was at least even an almost outdoor gathering of the church gathered together in one place. Obviously, in the early history of the church, you had house churches that may have grown larger. They may have met in larger assemblies, may have met outdoors. It's really hard to say, because I'm going to be honest, as much as I want to be completely faithful to the book of Acts and figuring all these things out, we're given a whole lot more than some people want to admit, but we're not given as much as our questions might reach when we think about how to actually organize the church and its ministries. Lane, I'll tell you, I think as I see it, trying to put this together in terms of a New Testament ecclesiology, I think there's an acceptable range of innovation and adaptation, and then we got to figure out what's outside that range. I'm very concerned about churches that, for instance, would have video presences elsewhere, which I think really robs the preaching of the word from its authenticity, having a preacher and a flesh and blood preacher there doing the preaching. I'll tell you, though, where there's no word at all in terms of evangelism, yes, I'm glad for people to hear an authentic, faithful, biblical message, whatever the medium. But when we are organizing the church, we're not just trying to say, all right, what could we get away with? We're trying to say, how do we show the church in its fullness? How do we live out the church in its fullness? If you decide to have separate services, as most churches in large cities have, then it's more or less the same decision as having different services in different places. There needs to be some opportunity for the church to gather together. I think that's very, very clear. Whether it's for every service with everyone in the room, I think it's where we really need to struggle with it even further. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We'll be back with more on the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to Ask Anything Wednesday in the Albert Mueller Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We have good questions coming in from email and Twitter and Facebook. We'll get to as many of those as we can. But we're giving priority today to calls. Let's go to Josh, listening on the World Wide Web, calling from Arkadelphia, Arkansas. Go ahead, Josh.
Hey, Dr. Mueller. Thanks for taking my call. I've been taught dispensational premillennialism.
Yeah.
And heard you talking a couple of weeks ago about historic premillennialism. And where would be a good book to do some reading on that? I've got Danny Aiken's Systematic Theology book, and Russell Moore wrote about that. But he kind of gives an overview of the different views. Where would be a good place to start?
My dear friend Russell Moore, who often serves as the guest host of this program and as senior vice president and dean of the School of Theology here at Southern Seminary, he did contribute to that book, wrote a great chapter on eschatology. I think he would probably define his position as a modified dispensationalism, more classically. I hold to a historic premillennialism, and those are very compatible positions. We're happy to teach together, happy to worship together, happy to be on the same teaching team in a local church together. But I do think historic premillennialism is the most natural understanding from the biblical text. And so I would suggest to you, Josh, just in terms of reading, there's a New Testament scholar, now deceased, by the name of George Eldon Ladd. That's L-A-D-D. He wrote a book entitled The Presence of the Future. Very good book. I would suggest you, just looking at the book of Revelation, looking at Greg Beale's commentary. That's B-E-A-L-E. Good stuff. We put some links up to these resources. Also, there's a book, and this is one of these fun books, and I love doing these. I'm actually writing in one myself for Zondervan right now. They're called Five Views books. Sometimes they're not five books, five views. They're four, but nonetheless, The Meaning of the Millennium. That's a very interesting book. You read The Meaning of the Millennium, and I believe it's in that book that George Eldon Ladd actually presents the premillennial, historic premillennial position. And then there are other alternative positions, and the fun thing about those books is that the authors engage each other. They respond to each other. It's like having a seminary course in the covers of a book. It's a lot of fun, and I think you could find some really good stuff there, Josh, and I appreciate your call. Appreciate you listening to the program. That really excites me. You got a caller who says, I was listening, and it made me think, and now I want to read about it. And when you're thinking about how to exercise the Christian responsibility of the intellect and how to grow and mature as Christians, you know, that's just phenomenal. You hear about something, you start thinking about it, you realize the biblical significance of it, and you say, all right, I'm going to go read on that. Josh is a good example for us there. Thanks for your call, Josh. Let's go to State College, Pennsylvania, where Regina's on the line. Go ahead, Regina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
I'm glad to hear from you. What's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question. I vaccinate my children, and I have a little concern about the vaccinations I've been hearing that are derived from aborted fetuses. What is your view on that?
Well, I think it's very problematic, Regina, but I'll tell you, in terms of what is currently available in terms of vaccines in North America, there is very little complication from the cells of aborted fetuses. And yet you have to go backwards and say, how do we get here? Most of these vaccines are derived from cell lines and serum lines that have existed now for decades. For instance, when they're making these flu vaccines, whether it's H1N1 or what we just kind of call the normal flu, it comes around every year, that virus is mutating all the time, but they don't go back to ground zero. They're actually using some biological materials that had existed before, and that's actually important to the process. It's far more effective, and again, I'm not a pharmacist, but I'm told it's far more effective and saves lives to go back and use these pre-existing biological material lines. Now, what happens is that somewhere back there, there was an original biological donor. And that's where the problem is, Regina. You're really looking at the fact that somewhere back there, someone did what I believe was fundamentally wrong and used some cells. I don't know how much, but they used some cells from aborted fetuses. By the way, in Europe right now, that's considered no big deal. In most European countries, that's just no big deal at all. As a matter of fact, there are collagen compounds used in cosmetics in many European countries that routinely use biological materials from aborted fetuses. I think that's abhorrent. It's almost unimaginable to me. And tomorrow or Friday on this program, we're going to be talking about the fact that there is now a cosmetic product line here in the United States that is also explicitly using a material from aborted fetuses. But when it comes to the vaccines, Regina, the best I know to say is that you're now looking at no way to go back and restart that process. That's where it was. It's kind of like where we are with the Nazi medical experiments. It's not legitimate to bless those Nazi medical experiments. They were abhorrent. They broke every principle of medical ethics. They're simply horrifying. But there is knowledge that came from them that is now used in modern medicine. That doesn't justify what happened, and it doesn't lessen our responsibility to condemn what happens. But there's actually no way now to go back and undo that from the totality of medical knowledge as it has expanded since, say, 1945 and the fall of Nazi Germany. It's impossible, literally, to go back and decontaminate modern medical knowledge from some of the illegitimate sources of that knowledge. And it's the same way with the virus and the serum. It's impossible now to go backwards and undo all of that. So, Regina, one of the things I'm saying to you is that it's not just about the vaccines. It's really about almost every aspect of medicine. There's going to be some complication like this. And so when you realize that, you have to say, well, it will be wrong intentionally to use the vaccine because it includes this. But I do think it's allowable, Regina, to go ahead and vaccinate your children using these vaccine lines, these serum lines, that now cannot be undone from what is now a very diluted presence of biological material that could indeed, if you could do the DNA study, be traced back to cells drawn from an aborted fetus. It's a reminder to us of how we live in a fallen world, Regina. And when I think about what this means for us, it's just a reminder that all of creation is groaning for the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. In the meantime, almost every technology we use has some kind of ethical complicity. The Christian principle to keep in mind here is that it is wrong to do anything to further that moral culpability. If it led to any other use of cells from an aborted fetus, if it led even more fundamentally to the abortion of even one baby anywhere on this planet, then it would be wrong to do it. But if that is not the effect, and if it was not the intention, and if there is no way to undo the good from the bad in this case, to take an absolute purist position would mean we can almost use no modern medicine at all. And I don't think that's where Christian moral wisdom would have us land. Thanks so much for your call. I love a call from a committed mother who's even worried about this. That's very good news for us all. We'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. That was a classic rebroadcast of an Ask Anything Wednesday. I always appreciate those who call in. That's really, really important. And we appreciate you waiting on the line as we try to get to your questions. And let me tell you, I am just thrilled by the quality of questions that come in by this radio audience, not only by phone. Remember, we're always glad to hear from you. Mail in your questions to mail@albertmueller.com. And let us hear your questions also at Twitter. It's just twitter.com/AlbertMueller or /MuellerRadio. And by the way, I'm glad for you to follow at Twitter. I do many, many updates in the course of a normal day. And during the day, if something happens, we'll be responding to that and pointing to links and analysis also. That's just /AlbertMueller, no space. Also at Facebook, the Albert Mueller Program. Good questions from all sources. Always welcome. So are suggestions. And by the way, I want to thank one caller who called in with a suggestion about a book that's out, and I've since had at least a cursory opportunity to look at the book, and yes, we're going to have to talk about it. Given the way we talk about marriage and so many other things, it's one of those books that demands some conversation. The book is by Lori Gottlieb, and its title is Marry Him, The Case for Settling for Mr. Good Enough. And it's a very interesting article. I mean, several things we talked about on this program. It's at the intersection of the delay of marriage. It's at the intersection of more women than men in the undergraduate programs across the campuses of America. It is at the intersection of the issue where women say they want to marry up in terms of education and profession. And that's becoming increasingly difficult. If women are not going to number young men on the college campus, well, guess what? The math's not going to add up. Lori Gottlieb has written an article, basically a book, actually arguing that women need to stop looking for Mr. Ideal and then settle for Mr. Good Enough. Now, it's not going to be just a story about her argument about a woman settling for Mr. Good Enough. It could be about a man settling for Mrs. Good Enough. The point is, from a very secular perspective, it raises the question of what you should look for in a spouse. And, you know, as Christians, we're going to be looking at a very different set of equations. That's what makes a book like this really interesting. What would a secular person set out as a secular argument for Mr. Good Enough? And would that argument be good enough for a Christian? Well, I think not. But that's the kind of thing we're going to get to. And we know about it, well, because some of you help us to know about it by bringing it to our attention. So you see a book, you observe a movie, you see something happening, you see a news story, you say, that's something I wish we could have some intelligent conversation about. Send me the link. Send me the reference to the book. Let me know what's going on, and I will appreciate it. Folks, we got some big things coming up in conversations in days to come. After all, the news never stands still. Just imagine what's happening this very week, coast to coast, all kinds of things going on in public conversation. And it's not just the conversation in the media, it's the conversation in the PTA meeting, the conversation in the Boy Scout troop, the conversation with your neighbor over a cup of coffee, the conversation over the water cooler at work, and very significantly, the ongoing conversation on America's college and university campuses. We want to be a part of that too. See you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.